Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Robert?
Today, Russell, I am feeling like I'm screaming.
Yeah, go on.
Today's guest's work has frequently, I have noticed, been described as yelling and screaming. I think yelling is probably used more in the USA lexicon, but in the UK we say screaming. And also, I remember when I was a teenager, people used to call me a screaming gay because I was like a young queer teenage boy who was always a bit too camp for the likes of the rugby team and the people at school. And actually, it was in my teens that I first saw the work of today's guest. And she is someone, for me, who I've always felt a really strong allyship with. I know we recently interviewed Judy Chicago, and in the past we've interviewed other artists like Joyce Pensato and Tracy Emin and so many cool feminist icons. But today's guest, for me, feels like the most visceral, the most kind of, I don't know, there's just an energy in the work that's just liberating. And screaming was the only way I could think to feel today. And over the past almost six decades, that's right, 60 years of art making, today's guest has set up a gallery, numerous times been censored, faced misogyny through different decades and different kinds of misogyny, and just constantly forged ahead and never stopped, and has got this power within, which you feel in the work. So we are proud, I'm so proud to welcome to Talk Art a living legend, the one and only Judith
Bernstein.
Yes!
Hi, Judith.
Hi there. This is thrilling for me too. This is great.
You're very, very generous to join us today, Judith.
Oh, we really
are.
This is actually my pleasure, and it's wonderful to speak to you guys. Before I, in the morning, I checked out some of the other people who spoke, and it was just a great talk, great conversation, good interaction. It's wonderful.
Fantastic. Aww. So where do we find you? Are you in Chinatown in New York City at the moment?
That's right. I live in Chinatown. I've been here since 1967, and I live on the fifth floor, and this is my home.
Is your studio connected to your home?
Yes, my home is my studio. My studio is my home, etc. Yeah, it's one big space. Yeah.
Did you wake up late today? I've heard that you've said the luxury of having a career is you can sleep late, but also stay up late.
I want to tell you something. I am someone, I don't care the fact that I'm really old. I still stay up to 2 o'clock in the morning, all 2-3 in the morning. It's very hard for me to get to bed early. I don't want the day to end. So it's really a pleasure. But I did get up a little earlier than usual. Otherwise, I would have slept at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, which is this time. But nevertheless, I wanted to be right here for you guys.
Were you born in New York?
No, I was not. I was actually born in New Jersey, a place called Newark, New Jersey. It's close, but it can be very far away in terms of aesthetically and culturally and all that. Yeah.
They've got an airport there, Newark, right?
Yeah, that's right. That one? That's right. That's it. That's it. Newark Airport. Yes. I wasn't born in the airport, but nevertheless, I was born in a hospital, you know.
Not the airport, right?
Not okay. The airport, yes. Yeah.
How did you learn about painting? Was it something in the family, or did you experience art at an early age?
Well, you know, it's very funny. My father was like a Sunday painter. He had a group of people came to the cellar, that little studio. They would paint, but really, I would say it was very. It was hardly commercial in any way. But I always loved to draw. And I love to paint, and that's how I started in. And it was really my passion. And it became an obsession and a passion as years went by. It still is.
It still is. Good.
Oh, no. I'm still here, by the way. Absolutely.
Was you encouraged by your family?
Yes. They would say, oh, you don't have to do something too hard. You should go to college and actually get into the art program because that's so much easier. Now, I was pretty smart, so I could have gone into some other field, but art was really, I went right straight to it and it was wonderful for me.
Where did you get the sense of self? Because it sounds like from your very early student days, you had a very distinct vision straight away when there were lots of other artists making kind of abstract expressionist kind of work and following in a way what men had made. But
that's
you always
right.
had this very unique language within your work, which I know didn't go down that well with some of your tutors and stuff. But where do you think that self sense of self and confidence came from?
Well, I think that I always wanted, you know, you were talking about shouting. I always wanted to have my voice and I wanted to be heard. And it's an extension in a lot of ways of my subconscious. So I went into my subconscious and I was interested in the psychology of the time frame. And I was, I thought about things to say about the culture in general, about the political, and I made it sexual. So all the work is political and sexual from right in the beginning. But it was very unusual for anyone to do that. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
When did that sort of link happen? Was it a eureka moment when you sort of linked that in your subconscious as being something that you could artistically use as a theme?
I think, by the way, it was the Vietnam time. I made a series called Fuck Vietnam when I was a graduate student at Yale. And Yale at that time was an all-male school as an undergraduate. And so I was quite aware of the male hierarchy, to say the least. So I had read an article in the New York Times, and it said, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was taken from Bathroom Graffiti. And I said, here, I found that link, by the way. So I went into the men's bathrooms and I got the idea of scatological graffiti, which was a lot of fun. There were limericks, by the way. There once was a man from Nantucket who had a dick so long he could suck it, that kind of thing. So I had, the limericks, by the way, I didn't make up, but I made up a lot of stuff. This may not be heaven, but Peter hangs out here. And for example, I did a large drawing of a Superman. He had a cock three times the size of him. He's flying through the air and he's super cock. And then I made one that was, Viet cock, which was Vietnam, that he had, from his rear to the White House, to the Capitol. And so I did a lot of, and I had one that was super zipper. He had a zipper on his cock. So I always had, by the way, things that were specific and also fun, because I felt that humor, which I always had a very raucous sense of humor. I feel that humor is almost like an ejaculation. I don't think it's quite as good as an ejaculation, I might add, but nevertheless, it does give you that pow. And so I was always interested in the sexual and the political, and I made that connection when I was a graduate student at Yale. Yeah. And at that, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I just want to go back on that story about Sir Edward Albee, when he's writing the play, who's afraid of Virginia Woolf, had seen in a toilet stall while he was defecating graffiti saying, who's afraid of Virginia Woolf? And that became the title. And so you read an article about this, and then you were inspired because did you have people like watching out so you could run into various men's bathrooms and record what was in there?
Well, it sounds like I'm a voyeur, but I'm not in terms of that in that way. Yeah. But I would go in with one of the guys in the art department, and he would stand at the door, and I was not really copying the stuff. Once you get the idea what scatological graffiti is about, you can just go with it. So I also, graffiti is something that people are in. Someone is in a bathroom, they're defecating, and it's a private space. So they just write down whatever they want, and there's no editing. So it was a great thing to see that. And my idea of feminism was observing the men and seeing what they're about. So I use graffiti as an entrance point at that time. That was in 1966. Yeah.
It's really interesting as well, because I read that you described it as being like an unconscious kind of creativity, because they're actually focusing on something quite bodily, like going to the toilet.
Right.
But
That's
instead,
exactly.
they sort of like mindlessly just, they aren't really thinking what they're writing. It's almost like the muse takes over. But the thing I thought was really curious about it is this idea of an audience, because they know that they're speaking to other men who are going to be sat in that toilet. So in a way, it's like them entertaining other people who might be there next.
That's right. It's like a very special club that uses that toilet. Exactly. And it's actually a fun thing, because most of them are, a lot of the things that were said were very clever and also very funny, but no one, it's anonymous, but it's an interesting way as an entrance to the subconscious. So I use that idea for my own political entry. Yeah.
Was that quite shocking when you started doing that, especially when you're at Yale? I think we briefly touched on censorship then, and I think I'd love to hear more about how you've been censored over the years. But when you started really exploring the penis, the cock, the dick in your art,
that's right,
and you're surrounded by men, what was that energy like towards you when you started exploring that?
Well, I think, by the way, that all the guys thought it was hilarious. They thought it was hilarious that a woman was doing it, and they would come to my studio and they'd say, "Oh, dick, prick, cock," you know, and cunt, and they'd go into all the scatological stuff. And this was great for me. I was making a dictionary of crude, obnoxious words. And it was raw. And also, when you're talking about war, the horror of war, by the way, is very raw. Nothing can be as bad as what war does, by the way. So even the crudeness, it was appropriate for anti-war, fuck Vietnam, by the way. And at that time, there was an enormous amount of people who didn't, men who were drafted, they didn't want to go. And they were, sometimes the work was actually very sad. I have a wife and two children, and I'm going to war. I'm going to Vietnam, and I hope I come back. So it was also things that were funny, but it was also things that were dead serious.
So when you went to Yale, you were saying that, you know, the undergraduate course for like 268 years, it was only men that were on the course. So when you did attend, you were one of, what, three women, I think?
That's
right.
And
the rest were men?
That's right. And there were three women in the class that I was in at Yale. They always had women in the graduate program, but they had very little. But the undergraduate program was all male. So you were in a deep testosterone cell, by the way, all the time. And guys got a kick out of what I was doing. In a way, what I was doing was larger than the School of Yale. It was really large enough to be part of the art world, but I had no idea or any idea of how to get into the art world at that point in time.
And you had an artwork that was banned from an exhibition at
Yale.
That's
right.
which was called Penis Pink, I think it was called, yes.
Penis Pink, that's right. That was my favorite color, by the way. Penis Pink, yes, exactly.
Well, I think we've already answered one of our final questions that we have for you. But yeah, Penis Pink, my favorite color as well. Yeah,
I'll tell you something. Barbie, forget about Barbie, by the way. Penis Pink is what it was. But they had a sequel. That's right. They had a big show from Yale students at the mall and at Yale, and I was in that show, and they called up the head of the Yale school at that time. It was Lester Johnson, who's not with us, as they say, and he called me up, and he wanted me to take that piece out of the show. And I was shocked, by the way. I mean, I was shocked because they would ask me to do that. But nevertheless, I did bow to that. I did take it out. You know, you're a student. You know, you don't know anything. And not only that, you have someone who's the head of the Yale Art School tells you you should do this. I'll tell you something. He said, oh, this is not the right venue. Well, I'm going to tell you something. Whatever you have to say is always the right venue. Yeah. It was fuck Vietnam. It was a fuck Vietnam painting. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
Right. So dealing with censorship as a young student, like you said, you were in shock. Sure. Did that feel quite scary then? Like you were doing something that could risk, imprisonment or could risk arrest or...
Well, I didn't go as far as to think about imprisonment. I know that I even sent slides to Kodak because I would take photos of them and have them reproduced. And they wrote me a note. They said, we don't reproduce this kind of work. We don't reproduce this kind of work. So I had problems from the get-go, but I never realized how that would impact when I went out into the outside world and how that would be. Yeah.
I think it's just incredible that you've stayed with your vision, that even though you were having this censorship and you were having people saying, don't do this, we don't want this here, your determination, that how you held on to that is so inspiring.
Well, it's funny. I felt that art to me was something that it was about what I'm about. And I felt I had to say that. Art was not, you see, at that period of time, people never made any money. You'd sell a drawing for $75. I mean, we're talking about a whole different time frame. So it wasn't about economic, they thought that what everyone would do would get a job in academia. And that would be how they could make a living. Now, with women, we didn't get jobs in academia. They said, I had gone to a job interview and they said, well, the only reason we'd ever interview a woman had to do with the fact that we wanted a nude model. This is Connecticut College for Women. We have a nude model in the class and we don't want a man to see her. Now, that is so puritanical and it is off the wall. I said, do we get the same amount of money? They said, oh no. I said, this is not going to work for me. I always had a big mouth. I want to tell you something. If you have a big mouth, you don't get hired. That's a way to say, fuck you, man. I'm not coming here. I'm not going to be here. Yes.
Wow. Yeah. It reminds me of the Carmen Herrera story where she said she went into a gallery that was run by a woman. And the gallerist said to her, you run rings around all my male artists, but I'm not going to give you a show because you're a woman. And that was correct. A woman to a woman at the time.
Yes, yes. People said things that you cannot believe today because but nevertheless, at that time, there was no censorship. People just said whatever came out. So they would say things that are, you could take someone to court today. Not that I'm doing that, but that's really what happened at that period of time.
And if you think of I know a lot of people had a kind of issue with your very strong aesthetic right from the get-go.
That's right.
And there were other artists at the time, women artists even, sure. like Helen Frankenthaler and all the whole body of artists who were making, in a way, art that's responding to other art.
And
whereas with you, I feel like it's much more your own thing. But what were looking at? Who were your heroes?
Well, what's really funny? People assume that when you're an artist, you go back in time and you look at what's happening at this point and you make a variation on what's around. That, to a certain extent, you want to have in your own vocabulary, in your own head, all the information about art going back to Mesopotamia. But the fact is that there's so many things that affect you that is not about art. It's about, and I mentioned about graffiti, it's about the political time frame, it's about a lot of, it's much larger. And I was aware of that because it's what I wanted to say. And it turned out that that's what I had to say, and I did it. I have to say that I was not selling this stuff. This was not like, oh, you, and I was kind of lucky to get a academic job, and the jobs I got were very pathetic. they were part-time. They were, they were really bottom line jobs, by the way. But nevertheless, I still did what I wanted to do. I didn't feel that, for me, I wouldn't get enough out of it to copy or have an extension of work that was around. I had to have my own voice. And I know that when I was a child, I was in my parents had a terrible marriage, and they were always screaming and yelling all the time. And you had to scream and yell to be heard. So I took that literally, and I ran with it as an adult. There was a sad comment, by the way. This is what happens with a dysfunctional family.
Become artists.
Yes, they become artists. What else we can do, you know?
When did you notice then a shift when it came to the financial side of your practice then?
Well, I'll tell you something. At that time, you could live on nothing. When I graduated Yale in 1967, you could live on nothing. I was making $9,000. That's gross salary, by the way, without art supplies and all that. I was making like $9,000 a year. Now, if I tell people like that, you'd actually be homeless. You'd be on the street. But nevertheless, at that time, New York was very cheap, by the way. When I moved into my loft, it was $175 a month, and it was about 1,800 square feet. So now, of course, that kind of thing is like $7,000 a month. So it was a whole different time frame, and because I've seen all things change. And I was very lucky because the aesthetic that I have, which is very direct, by the way, it's scatological, it is the zeitgeist of this time. And I was very lucky that that happened, because you could do something and not be the zeitgeist of the times. So it worked out for me, but there's no guarantee. I did a show in California a few months ago that said, "We don't owe you a tomorrow." you're not guaranteed, because you do something and it's worthwhile for you, that it's going to catch on or you're going to sell work. Only recently have I really started making money on the work that I do. And it's been fabulous. I'm glad I lived this long. Good. That's the advantage of living a long life.
That's so true. Yeah. I remember in 2012, I think it was, when you had your new museum kind of small retrospective.
Right.
And I was so happy at the time, because I was just like, thank God, you know.
Yes.
And then also when you had your UK solo at Studio Voltaire a few years later, and it was just so vibrant.
It
and
was
I know that
fabulous.
You actually made those works in Studio Voltaire, didn't you? You actually did a kind of residency.
Well, I'll tell you something. I did a residency and it was great. Joe Scotland is fabulous. And he asked me, oh, you know, why don't you come and see the space and all that kind of thing? And I did. I went to see the space, and it is a repurposed church, which it was a Methodist church at one time. And I said, this is perfect for my work. At the head, by the way, that's like the altarpiece, you have a big cunt, by the way. So we have Mary, by the way, and we have a big cunt, cockeyes cunt, by the way. And then we have these large, very 15 foot long penises, by the way. And matter of fact, one of those pieces is in the show, the Emalin show that is opening this Thursday. It's going to have a opening from 6 to 8 Thursday. It's opened on Friday, and it will run through June 15th. So you'll get a chance to see that one piece. But that one piece was a lot of screw drawings we had. I made 5. So they're marching up, by the way, to the altar that's a cunt. You know, so No, it was just fabulous. And also, I made the pieces as large as possible. So therefore, you're enveloped by the scale of it and you feel infantilized. So it was wonderful visually and it was great. I did have another room there. And the other room had a large fluorescent, install painting, painting. And I was...
Was that glow in the dark, wasn't
it? It's glow in the dark. That's exactly right. And I used fluorescent paints, fluorescent lights. And it was a killer, by the way. You go in and whoa! And so it was a wonderful install. My assistant, John Reynolds, came with me and we worked night and day, by the way, on these, you know, I'll tell you something. London has the worst fucking ladders you could ever imagine. They have these ladders instead of like an A ladder. They have these ladders that go like this, and you're staying up here. And not only that, I'm an old lady, by the way, and I'm up here and I'm painting, etc. I figured this may be my last piece, by the way, but nevertheless, it worked. It worked out okay. They apparently know what they're doing, but it's scary as hell. Those ladders, killer ladders. Yes.
So these screw drawings that we refer to, these were something that began as an act of oppression, as a symbol against Mao aggression, especially. And they began in 1969?
Yes,
and
that's
Or was
right.
it earlier on?
They were also a little earlier, but I started really getting... I made a series that the screws became a phallus. So first it was a flathead screw, then it was a metal screw, and then it was a wood screw. So they got rounder and rounder, and then it became a phallus. So that trajectory started my series of screws. At that time, there was a lot of interest in hardware, and I named a lot of the pieces hardware. So it's funny, it's hardware, but also hardware, a hardware store has a lot of things that are very sexual. All the titles. So it was funny when you go to these places, these hardware stores. Guys love to hang out at hardware stores, and I know why, by the way.
I love a hardware store.
Yeah, exactly. So, those hardware stores are dynamite, by the way. I know that.
Some of these drawings are humongous, like some are 30 feet across. How long do they take for you, and what does this huge scale give you as an artist for your message?
The screws drawings are power symbols. So they were just dynamite. and mine is bigger than yours. And I have to tell you that I always loved the humor in all this work, because the humor allows you to see the work, accept it, and run with it, by the way. And it's also, you remember it better. And also, it takes off the onus of the pieces. It makes it much more palatable to the viewer. But it does, now, I made a piece that was my most well-known piece that was censored in Philadelphia. It was called Horizontal, and it was 9 feet I only know feet. Sorry about that. Not 9 feet by 12 feet. And that piece I did in 1973 was censored in Philadelphia, and I just sold it last year to the Metropolitan Museum.
Wow.
So it took a long time, man. But I got it.
so when it comes to the scale, size matters for
Yes,
you.
It does. You know something? You find that you are infantilized by the scale of it. You are very small in comparison. And it makes it very clear that it is a... it is sexual, it is political, and it is a power. It shows you the power of the screw. And you know what's funny? I feel that women have a cock too. Now guys, by the way, literally have a cock, but women have a metaphorical cock. The fact is that the guys have the object, but they don't own the image. So I made a lot of these, and they became feminists, by the way. So they were my answer to feminism. It's a twist. It's a twist on the male phallus. Yeah.
as a black pioneering feminist artist, then with that image, did you ever come up against other feminist artists who were rejecting the cock, who were sort of feeling like you? This was kind of anti-feminist in some way at the time.
That's right. That's absolutely true. I did not get a lot of support for a lot of women. They felt that they couldn't see the cock as being feminist. They did not see that. And I was rejected from a lot of feminist shows as a result. They didn't see me observing men as being feminist. That's my idea of feminism. If it was not a cunt, then it was not self-reflective, and that was their narrow definition. Yeah.
It's interesting that, though, as well, because if you look at the history of art, it was often the female nude. And that's what I found so refreshing as a teenager when I saw some of your work, was like this idea that it wasn't that. And also the anthropomorphism of it and the way that it's almost like cartoony, felt like is more imaginative in a way, that there's some sort of like openness to how you can access it because of that open imagination or something.
That's right.
There's kind of like a playfulness.
That's right. And there's a certain playfulness to it. It actually looks very ominous when you see them. I also did a series that were these vertical screws, and they were like, and those vertical screws looked like missiles. They were like 20 feet tall. They were standing on end. And they were vertical, and those looked ominous, by the way. And they were very anti-war, and they were very warlike. And that one of the biggest, I had a 5-panel vertical that I did in 1973, and it was shown at AIR Gallery, and then that was sold to the Carnegie Museum. So that, you know, it's funny because a man, Carter Foster, who used to be at the Whitney as the head of the drawings department, I remember he said to me, "Do you have any paintings from that period?" I said, "I do, but they're really crude." He said, "Great, by the way, you know, we want to see them. I'm bringing Scott Rothkopf down immediately, you know." But he said, "If it doesn't have an edge, it's not good years and years later." So that it had that rawness. And all my work, by the way, the paintings, the drawings, the prints, everything I do has an enormous amount of energy. And the energy is what it's about. It has it is about the energy not only of the phallus, but I make all kinds of connections. I had these not only drawings of Fuck Vietnam with the cocks, then I had the screw drawings, and then I had the signature piece, which the screws were my signature. And then I made a gigantic signature, literally my signature, Judith Bernstein, 16 by 65 feet. And that became my signature. And then I made anti-AIDS stuff where guys were jacking off, and it was an extension of Matisse, by the way, dance. And I had word pieces, which two word pieces are going to be in this show that's opening next week. And that is, truth and chaos. But I had a lot of word pieces that when I did them in the 90s, in the early 90s, they were not as relevant as they are today. But it's amazing because time changes the definition of what a work is about. And then I did Birth Universe, and I equated birth of the universe with human birth. And now, when I was a kid, there was only a couple planets. Now, by the way, there's so much more information that we actually have telescopes that can go back to the Big Bang. I mean, it's mind-boggling. And I had anti-Trump. I did anti-Trump series. I despise Donald Trump, by the way. The only thing good about him is not as bad as Hitler. That's just about the only thing we can say about him. And I did at the Drawing Center and at Paul Kasman, I did Cabinet of Horrors, and I did Money Shot, which is the name of them. But I had Trumpenschlong, Putinschlong, and all these great titles. And I did Count Trump with Fangs. Count Trump. And I had Death Universe and Gaslighting, did the first to do gaslighting in 19. And gaslighting, originally people thought it was only about Trump, but gaslighting is neutral. It is not. It's not gender based. It could be men against men, men against women, women against men, etc. And hot hands. And now I'm doing a series that is called Death Head. So I'm these Death Head series, and they're killer.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
And you know, and the killer, by the way, what's great about these death heads is that before, sometimes I have been working with acrylic a long time and a combination of acrylic and oil. And now all these death heads are oil, and they are just extraordinary. They're just extraordinary. And it is about the zeitgeist of the times, because now there's so many things that each time we listen to the news, there's something worse than the last time around. So you have Gaza, you have Afghanistan, you have, it just goes on, you know.
And Ukraine.
Ukraine, it's just horror, by the way, so much stuff. And it looks, and if Trump comes in, I'm afraid we're going to have World War III, because I thought that from the beginning, because he's so inept, by the way, and he's, it's too bad that so many people are disillusioned and don't feel they've gotten what they wanted out of this life. And they are thinking that Trump can actually bring it to them. And that is, of course, ludicrous, because he is so clueless about almost everything. But anyway, you have that all over the world, because you have Hungary, you have many Italy, you have many places now that have these autocrats that are running the country. It's very sad. It's very sad.
It also feels like you have a constant inspiration for your work then. If warfare is the big inspiration for your practice, you know, we're in such dark times. You must be constantly full of ideas.
Well, you know, I'll tell you something. The funny thing is that I used to watch the news all the time late at night. This is great, you know, et cetera. And then I would read the paper. I would stay up the whole night, by the way, because I was so upset about all the stuff. So now I try to do it earlier in the day. But sometimes I can't even listen, because there's so many horrible things that have happened at this time. It just, you know, the brutality with the Israeli situation and all the Palestinian stuff that's happening now, and the people starving. Both, you can be sympathetic to both and still be Jewish, you know, et cetera. You know, I came from a different time frame. When I went to Penn State as an undergraduate. When I was there, there were 3 men to every woman. Now, by the way, there are more women than men. Then I went to Yale, and Yale had all undergraduates were men. And now, by the way, that's not the case at all. So things have changed considerably. And then when I came into New York, it was I hit a glass ceiling, really. People didn't want the art that women did. And many women were like myself. They had gone to graduate schools and they wanted to exhibit their work. So we started this gallery, AIR, which turned out to be, we try to figure out a name. And usually the gallery has the name of the person who is the gallerist. And so, of course, I put in, by the way, I thought they should call it TWAT, 20 Women Artists Together. But I was ahead of myself. I was ahead of my game right there, too, by the way. But never, it would have been a great name, by the way. Yeah. But I'll tell you something. At the time, I knew that it was too far to the left. But nevertheless, it's been quite a ride, and it's not over. And I hope that I can live a long time so I can keep going. But it is, it's a wonderful, it's just a wonderful experience to be able to express yourself and also express yourself and see the work and not just put the work in storage or put it in a drawer, to see it on a wall and other people seeing it. It's a great thing. Go ahead, sorry.
Well, there's a quote on that just before Rob jumps in there that you said one of the biggest perks of success is if you can do a painting and have it shown right away.
That's exactly right. It's the biggest perk possible. And you know, people think it's because you make a lot of money. Many times you can have a show and sell very little or nothing. But nevertheless, the point is that you have made a statement and then people see it, they critique it, and therefore it's a wonderful thing, by the way. It is really extraordinary to have your voice heard and thinking that this is very important to do at this point in time. Yeah.
The reason I've always loved your work is that I feel like you wake people up and it's almost like you're being shaken by the shoulders to be like, what the hell are you doing? You can make a difference. And there's a lot of people, since we started the podcast, I used to say, oh, I believe art can change the world.
Right.
And then obviously, literally, it can't change the world.
That's
but
right.
I do believe it can change hearts and minds. What
yes.
do you feel about that? Because obviously your work is so loaded with all this messaging and meaning and deep soul, but also intense intellect. So do you believe that like art can sort of change the way people think and are?
Well, I'll tell you something. I'm hoping that will be the case. I don't know. And frankly, when you show your work, most of the time you're speaking to the people who are already converted to believe what you believe. Now, that's not always the case, by the way, because I've had people push back a lot with me too. But nevertheless, I do what I do. And I hope there is a chance for people to see things and to know that Donald Trump had the lawyer Roy Cohn, who was
in Angels in America, who was like anti, you know, he was part of the
that's right,
the witch hunt.
That's exactly right. And so you have so much information that may change some people's minds, and I hope it does. But I think it can, but it's a hard slog, by the way. It's not something that, oh, you put it out and someone's changed. You know, it's funny. I did a piece. I did a large painting that was yellow. That was a cash register. And it was one of those, what are they called? Slot machines. So it had the slot machine thing was a phallus. And the area that the money comes out of, it was a face, by the way. It looked like Hillary, I have to say. And three of the Donald Trump's heads that had a fool's head cap. And I felt it was a jackpot. And on top of it, I put Americana stuff. I put an American flag and I put on, I called it money shot, by the way, which I love crude terms because you don't forget it. And, at the time, I was not crazy about Hillary, but of course I voted for her over Donald Trump. That's what you always vote for the lesser of two evils. And she would have been far beyond belief better than Donald Trump. So that was very similar. A lot of people use that as the precursor, by the way, of the January 6th insurrection. You know, so it turned out I didn't know that was going to happen, but I had Nazi symbols on it and money symbols, you know, so a swastika and money symbols. But when I did these pieces, Donald Trump just came into power and everyone said, oh, she's gone too far. She's just gone too far. And now they said she hasn't gone far enough. You know,
do you think you could still face censorship, like the censorship that you were experiencing in the early 70s?
Yeah.
Do you feel like now in art, that's still a possibility, again, especially with the political things that you're tackling?
Yes, I do think so. I'll tell you frankly, people will say, do not send this because I will not put it up. You know, so people will tell you directly, I don't want that in the show. I want a piece of yours, but I don't want that. You know, I don't want anything that has a swastika on. I don't want anything that has, you know, a cock on it or whatever it happens to be. So I do think that things can be censored. With the censorship issue, this was in 1974, and it was at the Philadelphia Civic Center. And there were 170 works in the show by 86 artists, and they were beginning artists, they were up and coming, and they were also established artists. So you'd have myself as an up and coming, and then you'd have Louise Bourgeois and Nevelson and other people as well known artists. And at the Philadelphia Civic Center, they didn't want to have my work on there, and they said, We're taking this down. This can't be part of the show. And the people in the show protested, and they made buttons, by the way, for the opening that said, "Where's Bernstein?" So where's Bernstein? Where's Bernstein? But I didn't go to the opening because Walter DeMaria, a friend of mine, said, if you go to the opening, they're going to say, "Where's Bernstein? She's right in the corner," you know? So, but my work was censored. It was the Philadelphia Magazine had articles on it. The newspapers in Philadelphia Inquirer and stuff had stuff. So I think that, and a lot of people signed petitions and all that, but I did not get the work reinstated. I do think that there are places that certainly would not have would not show the kind of work that I do. And people will do that now. You know, certain galleries, say, I'm not going to show this work because I have clients that are, you know, Trump supporters.
Wow.
You know,
but I really believe that. I feel like there's this new conservatism happening. But I feel like we've had these huge shifts in the past few decades where, like, you know, we've got better representation for women, representation
Absolutely.
For black artists, people
That's
of color,
right.
queer
Absolutely.
Artists. But at the same time, there seems to be this weird thing happening where it's almost becoming like there's a new set of rules, which obviously a lot of those rules are brilliant, but it sort of limits what people can say. And I feel like I'm getting worried we're getting back to a time of kind of like a censorship, basically, and some kind of, you know, where you're being told how to make art.
Yes.
And it sort of takes away the freedom that I think some young artists are scared to even make a painting or say what they think because they're worried about making a mistake.
Well, you know, Altazia, it's funny because anytime there are rules, you don't realize they're not put down as rules, but they are. Certain things are much more in favor. They think they can sell, and artists and galleries are in the sell business. That's what they're about. So it's a sad comment, but that's what it is. Also, I find that when things are tighter economically, they put in women, artists of color, et cetera, because they go for less money. So you don't realize that the amount of money that they charge for the work is so much less than what Jasper Johns and et cetera. There was a large poster that the Gorilla Girls did, and they said for one Jasper Johns, you could buy one work for every woman who ever worked in history. That's what it's about. And it's scary, by the way. But nevertheless, there's a lot of things now that are much better than they used to be. So I'm saying this is negative, and that's true. But there is a lot of work now that is lesbian, you know, and gay, and also sexual and political and all that. Regardless, they're still out there, and you're interviewing me, and as a result, I'm getting a wider audience about work that is sexual and political. So that you are helping get this out. So therefore, there's more opportunity for people like myself. Yeah,
but you also keep people going. And I was thinking about that when I was talking about whether you can change the world, you know, through art.
Exactly.
In a way, your legacy and your like 60 years or 70 years of art making, whatever it ends up to be, 80 years, 100 years, hopefully.
I hope you're absolutely right there, by the way.
Because that legacy, though, keeps people going, doesn't it? And it keeps them realizing they should use their voice.
That's
and
right.
They should make the work.
Well, you know, I'll tell you something. When you're doing this, you give permission for other people to show. And that's what's, and students, by the way, to do this kind of work. You give them permission. Whereas at another time, they don't feel that is legitimate or they could do that. And it's wonderful because art can be so many things. And the longer it's here, the more chance you have of expanding what art can be. You know, it can be earth art. It can be, Maurizio Catalan, a banana on a wall. There's so many things, by the way, that are fabulous work. So art is an extraordinary thing. And if you can actually do it and live in that world, it is a true gift. And hopefully for me, a long life. I'm 81 now. I hope to live a hell of a lot longer. may not do it, but I'm hoping it'll work out. Yes.
Love might do it. I think you love making art.
I love it, by the way.
We love you.
And I love it. And I love you guys for wanting to have me talk and talk about my own work and talk about work that has a lot of energy and says a lot. And it has a subtext, a psychological subtext, so you really remember it. I had one painting, by the way, that was called The Fun Gun. It's an anatomical drawing of a cock with a trigger and this. So I use all the humor I can, and it also says a lot of things that is not that you don't see right away. There's a subtext. So this has been wonderful talking to you guys.
You've said you've always felt like an outsider looking in, and now you're very much on the inside.
Yes.
How does that feel? And do you wish for earlier success? Do you wish that you'd had this a lot earlier on in the career? Or are you happy the fact that it's now working out now?
Well, I'll tell you something. To be honest, I would have had a different life. I came from a middle-class background. My parents had no money. I worked, I had gone to Yale. I had I had 4 degrees. I taught in academia. That's how I made a living. And I taught part-time, which, you know, you don't get the same, you don't get the same amount of money and all that. But I was able to sustain a studio, not have assistants or storage space or anything else. But I was able to do what I wanted to do, and that was a gift. And I was also able to live in New York because at that time, prices were so cheap. I could live in New York, and it's wonderful to always, New York is a great city. There's so much things you can see. And London, by the way, is another great city that I'm glad to have invaded, by the way.
Yes, you're very welcome.
Yes, I came over here, yes. But nevertheless, the cities are showing work that have a great range. And it's just an extraordinary thing. And you know, when you go out and you see all the work that's being done, it is really a kick in the ass, by the way. It really is. It is just so super fab.
That's so
just
cool.
Super fab. Yeah. And I'll tell you something. There, for a long period of time, I did not show. I didn't show for 25 years. That's a long, long time. And I didn't sell either. So that was very hard, but it didn't stop me. Frankly, I thought I couldn't do anything else. At least I didn't want to do anything else, is the truth of it. So it was right for me to do that. And I think that when I tell people my own story, many times older people and older women feel that if that could happen to me, it could happen to them. That may be or maybe not. You know, it's more complicated than just saying that. But I think that this has been a fabulous life for me. You know, it's funny when you go places, people say, oh, you look so young. First, I don't look young. I look my age. But nevertheless, I mean, if I don't look 81, I look 80. But nevertheless, it's not how young you look. It's what you've done with your life. And that's really the legacy that you want to have. And it's a great thing.
Yeah, you're a possibility model. Judith. You are coming back to London. You have an exhibition, as we're talking about, Emmeline Gallery. Leo and Angelina, who run that, are amazing. The exhibition is called Truth and Chaos. So how did this show come about? And this is going to be in their brand new space in Shoreditch, which is an old, I don't know, what sort of building is it?
It's a gorgeous, stunning building, by the way. Oh, I love these historical buildings. I'm a great one with history and antiques. And also London is just, you know, we don't have any, we may have an edge on certain things, but not on history. London is a hell of a lot older. But
how did the show come about?
I have three galleries. I have Kasman in New York, and I have the box in L.A. that Paul McCarthy owns, and also his daughter, Mara McCarthy, runs. And also I have a Zurich gallery called Karma International. They made the connection, by the way, with the gallery, and they picked work that Karma had in their archives. Mm-hmm. So that's how that worked out. But I'm going to have, which is great, I'm going to have a show at the Kunstmuseum in Zurich, which is the largest museum in Zurich, and it may be one of the largest in the world. And they have a new building called the Chipperfield, and I'm going to have two giant spaces, two of the biggest spaces in the Chipperfield place, and I may have some work at the Basel Art Show. So, hey, great. And it's going to be, by the way,
sounds like joy.
It is. And it's in 2025. It's in March 2025. And they'll have a catalog and zines and stuff like that. So I'm working on that, and I'm thrilled to have it. Just thrilled to have it. Yeah.
Fantastic.
So you mentioned zines. Was that something that you've always loved participating within, you know, in the kind of agitprop kind of poster and zine universe?
I've actually done some zines, and I actually love them, by the way, because they're small, they're so doable. They cost almost nothing for the person, and they get a lot of my images, by the way. They get all these cocks, these masturbatory things and all that, but they get all this stuff, and they look wonderful. And this one that I'm doing is with Coma. They are wonderful. That name is part of Cornelia and Marcel. So the Coma is the name of it. It's in Amsterdam. And they're making these head drawings. I did it one time. I had a friend who lived near the Hamptons, and I would go out on the weekends, just not all the time, but sometimes. And I would sit down and I'd make a couple hundred drawings. And those drawings became a zine. And that is going to be printed up as we speak. And then I'm going to have also a zine with magic marker drawings. I did a large signature all over Alex Zachary's gallery a long time ago, and I broke my arm, so I did everything with my left hand. And
I broke it during the work.
What happened is I fell. And I was lucky because I fell on the first level. Had I fallen down, by the way, it was a ledge. It would have been 14 feet on my head. I would have died. But it worked out, and I broke my elbow. And the gallerist came over to me, and he said, "Oh my God, what happened?" I said, "Don't worry, I'm going to finish this piece." He said, "That's not what I'm worried about." He said, "That's not what I'm worried about," he said. But anyway, so I did those will be in, and Dick in the Heads, I have another series. I believe that your sexuality is in your head. And one piece that's in the email gallery is a fluorescent canvas with a drawing with a dick on the head, and it, and I made a series of those also with pastel. So you have a dick in the head, and you have a dick, by the way, the eyes are two balls, and the nose is another dick. So I have four. We're going to put them together, and we'll make a fat catalog for those. So I made a few zines with a couple other people too. So, but zines have been pretty pretty current. I've done them maybe for the last 15 years, but not before that. But I love the zines, by the way. They're just great.
That's good.
Well, you get this stuff out.
Hearing you talking about breaking your arm, it just reminds me of a quote where you said that I put my art above safety. My priority is my artwork, whatever the consequences. So even
That's
at that
correct.
Point, when you'd broken your arm, you're like, no, the work is more important than my...
That's right. And, you know, I said to the dealer, which is absolutely true, I said, I would have done this piece if I knew I was going to break my arm. I wouldn't have done this piece if I thought I would die. But nevertheless, I was willing to break an arm. And then I said... After I finished making the drawing with my left hand, I'm right-handed, I went to the hospital and I had to come back and they put me in the hospital. I had to have an operation. So it worked
Whoa.
Out. Yeah.
You know, one of the things I've really loved about you as well is that I feel like you really are the definition of an artist's artist. And I know that even our late friend Joyce Pensato, who Russ
yes.
was originally close friends with, and then I became friends with too, and
oh,
we actually
wonderful.
Ended up having shoots in her studio where we were models for her and all kinds of crazy shit. But I saw that in her reconstruction of her studio, when they do it within museums and galleries
right,
now,
right.
it actually had one of your pin badges.
That's
it's
right.
in there.
That's right. She
it
bought
was
a
so
painting.
Cool.
She bought a painting of mine, and she had one of the pin. It said Trump and Schlong. When I had the show at the Drawing Center, we made four buttons, and one of them was Trump and Schlong. One of my, you know, one was Judith Bernstein 2020, as if I was running for president, because it was done a while ago. And so I had a few of these buttons, and when people left the gallery after seeing the show, they picked up a button, and the buttons were really big, and they were really quite fun.
I love that. Well, before we get into our final questions, I have one more question to ask about.
Sure, go ahead.
You mentioned Paul McCarthy and his
yes.
gallery, The Box. Paul McCarthy was an artist that you connected to in 2008 and actually changed sort of the trajectory of your career at that moment.
That's
Can we
correct.
Talk about that? And it like a sort of mentorship in some capacity.
Yes, and you know something, it was quite fabulous. It turns out that I was having a show at a gallery called Mitchell Algis, and it was in 2008. And Paul McCarthy and his wife, Karen, they're a team, all the family is a team. And he came to New York and he saw my stuff, and he was familiar with my work, but not from seeing it really, but just like in press and stuff like that. So he was very interested in giving me a show in California. And he went to the gallery because he was interested in Robert Mallory's work. And Mitchell Algis had Mallory's. He represented Robert Mallory's work. So when Paul came to the gallery, he loved my work. He wanted to give me a show, and he wanted to buy some of the work and all that. So what happened was, his daughter came to New York about a month or two later, and she offered me a show over the phone, by the way. And that's how I met. I went to California. I met Paul, and we have a lot in common. We're both outrageous and crazy, and we love what we do, and it's my privilege to be able to have a life in this art.
And you both love the dick. I mean, the dick.
Oh, absolutely. And Paul was saying that my dicks, by the way, my dicks are mostly erections, and his dicks are limp.
They're always flaccid. He loves a flaccid dick. You love a hard dick.
Absolutely. By the way, and matter of fact, a couple of shows I called hard. the show at the New Museum I called hard. It's hard in a lot of ways. By the way, the work that I put in was hard. I had quite a struggle, which was hard, but it's also, the dick is hard. Yes.
Well, me and Rob love dicks, both hard and flaccid. So
we also love women,
yes.
and we are hardcore feminists.
Oh, good.
And I always want to remind everybody that men can be feminists too. And
I couldn't agree more. I've had a lot of support from men, by the way. So I don't want to think that just women are feminists. And many times women aren't, and men are feminists. And I know that when I was originally doing these anti-Vietnams, I was thinking that if the world were run by women, then we wouldn't have as many wars and all that. But I don't believe that's the case at this point, because Hillary was much more aggressive, Obama, by the way, was much more neutral. So I don't know if it's not just gender based. No, but I definitely feel that there are men who are feminists. No question about it. You don't have to convince me. And I'm glad you have me on the show. Hey, does that prove it or what?
It's total privilege.
Your actions speak for you. Oh, yes.
Well, we're going to get to our final questions now, Judith.
Sure. Go ahead.
The first one is that we ask three questions to every guest that comes in. The first one is, if you could do an art heist, you could steal any artwork in the world for yourself, what would it be and why?
Oh, my God. Well, it would be my own work.
Oh, right.
Yes. Love it.
You know, I'll tell you something. I'm a narcissist right at this point, by the way. So I'm going to steal all my own work. But you know something? There is enormous amount of great history, of great art in history. And there's enormous amount that have done by men. And now we're going to see enormous amount done by women. So that's great, by the way. Yeah. There's so many extraordinary pieces. But I'll say my own work. What's the next question?
The next question we might know the answer to, actually. It's, what is your favorite color?
I guess penis pink.
Yes, it's now my new favorite color.
But you know something, I do love working in charcoal. I like the messiness. I like the grandeur of it. I like black and white. And I think that I love charcoal. Yeah, so I would say black too. Yeah, pink and black.
Penis pink and charcoal. Lovely, lovely combination. Yes. And then what is the best advice that you've ever received when it comes to your art?
Keep going. Keep going. Don't stop. And you know something? When you hear a no, fuck them and move on. Because if you keep moving, you'll find a yes. And that's what's important. Because originally you think that the person who you're bringing something to is somehow an authority. You're not. You are the authority, by the way, and you have to keep moving on until you hear a yes. Yeah.
Yes, Judith. I love that.
Yes, Judith.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
We love you.
I love you too, guys. Yes. And when I come when you come to New York, I want you to come to my studio and you'll see all my work in person, which is great.
Do you know what? I'm actually coming this week. Maybe I can see you on Friday. Are you around on Friday?
Oh, wow. Maybe so. Well, write you
I'll
a
email
note.
You after.
That's great. Absolutely.
I'm only coming for like 4 days, but you never know.
Oh, great. Great.
If that works
Excellent.
Out.
Excellent.
Well, this has been
Wonderful.
Phenomenal. Thank you so much for spending time with us today, Judith Bernstein. It's just been heaven. For everybody listening, we're going to post images of everything we're talking about today. You're on Instagram, right, Judith?
Yes, I am.
Do you know your handle?
Yes, I think it's Judith underscore Bernstein. Yeah, great.
And then there's some amazing videos online of you in your studio. There's one at Studio Voltaire where you're actually, you just do like a search in Google, you can see where you're actually doing the big cunt face. And there's a video of you in your studio.
The one in my studio, the New York Times did, and that
wonderful.
Was a lot of fun.
Yeah. So good with you, with your cat.
Yeah. Oh my God! Yes,
hilarious. And then for the Emmeline Gallery, that will the show will be up when this episode is on.
Right,
and
exactly.
The exhibition is called Truth and Chaos, and everybody should get along to Shoreditch and see that.
Yeah. Judith, you're a legend. Thank you
Thank
for your
you.
Generosity and
Thank
your
you
never-ending passion for art. I love you so
Great.
Much, and we'll be
Great.
Back very soon. Thanks
Absolutely.
For listening.
Okay, take care.
Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.